for synergy. And so we've seen there's definitely something miraculous in our synergy. So this year, all the more so. So Chamishi of Vayishlach happens to be a subject which we've discussed already more than once this year. Because the whole episode with Shimon and Levi and Shechem and the Machlokas concerning what happened there is something that we have addressed in a few contexts. So on the one hand, we have an opportunity to synergize, but it's also good that we'll save some time on that topic because we have a lot to discuss. And we have more than you might think, because I realized looking back that we didn't have Shir last year. I think that was the week I was out, so we didn't do Revi last year. So our policy is we also have to make up Aliyahs that we missed from previous years to keep on track. So we're going to try to look a little bit at both Revi and Chamishi today. So we're lucky that we have a little bit of a head start on the major episode of Chamishi through having talked about it a few times. But in either event, we'll try to go relatively quickly through some of the ideas. So Revi begins, Vatigashna Hashvachos, Heina V'Yaldeya V'Tishtach Avena. So we encounter Esav, and the Shvachos come first, and they and their children bow down. Vatigash Gamleya V'Yaldeha V'Yishtach Avu, V'Achar Nigash Yosef V'Rachel V'Yishtach Avu. And then comes Leah and her children, and then comes Yosef and Rachel. So Rashi explains the difference in the phrasing here, that with all the Imahos, so they came first before the sons, but when it comes to Rachel, so Yosef came beforehand. And Rashi quotes that he's afraid that maybe Esav will express an interest in her, will feel an interest in her, so he decided to stand in front, and that's why he received the bracha of Ali Oyin, which the Gemara says in Masachas Brachos, this represents the fact that Yosef transcends the theme of Ayin Hara. And there's a whole discussion how to understand Ayin Hara. We won't necessarily get into it right now. But Ayin Hara is sometimes understood mystically, sometimes understood a little bit more rationally. So an interesting discussion once in between. But one of the ways understood is that provoking jealousy by showing off your good fortune is just in general not a good idea, and however you trace the path, it tends to cause problems. So here the Gemara says that Yosef, this bracha of Ali Ayin, means he is above the Ayin Hara, and he is somehow protected from it, so it makes sense, Mida Kenegin Mida, that he tried to prevent a jealous eye from settling on his mother, and that's a source of his chus. Okay, so Esav is impressed nonetheless. This is Vayomer Milucha Kalamachane Hazeh Asher Pagashti Vayomer Lemsachein Be'enei Adoni. So he said, what's pshat on all these people from this whole camp? And the response is, this is to find chein in your eyes, which some understand that it's specifically because Esav is more Gashmius oriented, is also more militaristically oriented. So now you see that Yaakov not only is spiritual, but he is able to impress Esav on his own terms with Gashmius, with a militarily capable entourage. So all of that is a way of saying, Esav, so you should appreciate this too. And Esav responds here, Vayomer Esav Yeshli Rav Achi Yelcha Ashela. So Esav says, I have enough, I have a lot, and you should keep what you have. So there, that whole language is very well known. We won't spend a lot of time on it because it is so well known, but we know that there is a contrast between the way Esav expresses himself with, I have a lot, and the way, it's interesting that some of the English translations render that as, I have enough, which is already kind of a judgment. That's not the literal translation, saying I have a lot. And the whole contrast with Yeshli Kol, with Yaakov, that I have everything, and that whole attitudinal difference that Esav says, okay, I'm rich, but I could be richer, I want more potentially, or I could want more, while Yaakov's Midas Hestapkos is such that he doesn't have that sense. So to translate it as enough is interesting, because Pashtus says it doesn't necessarily mean enough, that really Yaakov's Yeshli Kol is enough. Okay, In any event, so here there's definitely a contrast between the two expressions. Vayomer Yaakov, Alna imna matzasichein banecha, v'lakachta minchasim yadi, v'alkeg v'isif anecha kiros, v'nei yohim v'atirtzeni. So Yaakov says, please, you know, take my gift. And he says that I have seen you like seeing the face of God. So it's interesting here also that you find different types of implications of what he's saying. Is he saying that I see you as angelic? Or maybe, as some of the Rishonim quote, that he's saying that you should know that confronting angels and the like, on the one hand, you seem to be angelic, that's a compliment. On the other hand, you should also remember that I do okay confronting angels on your side. You know, that he had just survived this confrontation with the Tzara Shalesa, and perhaps that's a little bit part of his point as well. So in any event, what does Esav say? Vayomer Nisav v'neilecha v'elcha l'negdecha. So he says, let's go, let's take our journey, let's go, and I will walk next to you. I will walk alongside you. And Rav Soloveitchik in his drashos had a comment here that this idea of I'll walk alongside you, that this is typical anti-Semitic attitudes. That basically he's saying, why do you have to be different than me? Let's walk together. Let's walk in the same path. You don't have to distinguish yourself with your more spiritual focus. Let's equate ourselves. And that seems like a nice expression, but it's a way essentially of saying, why do you have to be so different than the rest of us? So to continue, Vayomer Elav, Adoni, Yodea, Ki Haladim, Rakim, Atzom Vabakar, Avosalai, Utfakum, Yom Echad, Vameisu, Kolatzom. So he says, well, you know, it's a nice idea, but I can't really do it because I have all little children, and I have the animals, and I just can't walk as fast as you, so you go ahead, but it was a nice one. Yavrna Dani Lishnei Abdo Vani Eskahalal Iti the Regal Hamlacha Shalafana the Regal Hayaladim Ada Shiravo Aladini Seira. So please you go ahead. I'll go slowly based on the pace of my cattle and the children until I reach you and say it. Vayomer Esav Atziga Na Imcha Min Ha'am Asher Iti Vayomer Lama Zeh Emsechein Ve'enei Adoni. So Esav says, let me leave you with some of those who are with me. And he says, well, I don't need that. I just need to find grace in Hashem's eyes. Vayasha Vayomahu Esav Adarkos Ira. So Esav went back on his way to Seir. Vayakov Nasa Sukosa Vayivin Lobayis L'miknehu Asa Sukos Alkein Kara Shem Hamakom Sukkos. So here, this is an interesting pasuk. Pasuk tells us that Yaakov journeys to a place called Sukkos. We understand actually why it's called Sukkos in the same pasuk, because he made Sukkos, so he called it Sukkos. But even that doesn't really explain it so clearly, because he made for himself a house, and he made Sukkos for his animals. So he decided to name the place after the structure that he made for his animals, which is itself interesting, and it's a topic of a lot of discussion. The Tur in Or HaChaim in Taf Yud Zayin writes that all of the regalim that we have, the three regalim, all parallel the avos. We've spoken about in the past few weeks how the tefillos, the three tefillos a day, parallel the avos. So apparently, so do the regalim parallel the avos. That Avram, we know the whole story about his Afnasas Orchem, apparently took place on Pesach, and Yitzchak correlates to Shavuos because Matan Torah is the Schos Diakeid, the whole story. And Yaakov, yes, his identity also connects to Sukkos. Why? Because of this pasuk. So that's also surprising, because it doesn't seem like this pasuk is the identifying slogan of Yaakov, the same way that Avram Tachnasas Orchem and Yitzchak Zakeda stand up for him. So too, this pasuk about Sukkos and Yaakov is so fundamental. So many comment about this, and the Malbim notes and others have the same idea also, that the house that he made, so that the Targum explains, that's the Beis Medrash, he sat and learned, and that was where he housed his spiritual activities. And his property, his animals, so that was in a Diras Arai. So it was a statement to basically saying that this Ruchnius is his central focus, and his Gashmius, he understands, is temporary, and that's also one of the themes of Sukkot, that we're recognizing that our house that we live in all year round is not necessarily what it's all about, and we can step out of that and encounter Kadosh Baruch Hu's protection a little more directly. Maharam Shek writes along similar lines also, that this is a remez to seeing God's Hashkacha in all of his affairs. So here his business he puts in a sukkah, which is exposed to God's Hashkacha. The Arachayim has a comment where he says that just like Yaakov was makir tov to his animals, he recognized that his animals helped him out, so therefore he made a structure for them, albeit a temporary one. So too, we're also makir tov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for Yetzias Mitzrayim, and therefore we make sukkos to him. It seems like a little bit of a stretch, not perfectly parallel, but the idea that somehow this is not simply an event, this is not simply a pasuk telling us about an incidental stop, but rather it reflects much more than one might think, something central to Yaakov's philosophy and his perspective on life. Okay, so the pasuk continues. Pasuk confess, V'yavo Yaakov shalem ir shchem asher beretz Kanaan b'vol mipadan aram v'yichan es pnei ha'ir. So Yaakov came to shalem, the city of Shechem in Canaan, and he came from Padan Aram, and he set up his tent in the city. And Shalem is a place where Rashi explains also Shalem Bebufo, that he was healed from his confrontation, Shalem Bemono, that he wasn't lacking anything from the property, Shalem Betaroso, that even all this time in Laban, he didn't forget his learning. The Medrash has a comment about this idea that he was shalem. So it says the Medrash, V'lamo, why was he so shalem? Because the pasuk says in last week's parasha, Yaakov, 2 weeks ago, Yaakov Nishtam Yoshev Oholim, that he was tamim, and he sat in tents, plural, that's the Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. So this idea of Tmima somehow explaining why he's shalem, so there is an interesting discussion about this in the comments of the Maharam Sheikh. And say from Maharam Sheikh Al Torah, Maharam Sheikh we've mentioned in the past was a Talmud of the Chassam Sofer, and the Sefer that's available Maharam Sheikh Al Torah is mostly a Likud, the comments that he has in other places. Before that, he's well known for his Sefer Shalos and Chubis, and he also has a Sefer on Mitzvos. So nowadays, you can get the Sefer on Chumash, you can also get a Sefer on Pirkei Avos. I think both of them are Likutim from other Svarim, but both in the Sefer and Pirkei Avos and here, he talks about a machlokas, the philosophers, the Jewish philosophers, about what is the purpose of life, what's the ikar avoda. So according to the Chovetz HaLevavos, in Shar Yichud Gimel, and the Shla, and the Marshal, and the Sefer Achinuch, the ikar avoda is to understand the Kadosh Baruch Hu. But he quotes that there are others who say differently, like the Sefer HaBris and the Derech HaMuna, that the ikar is really tmimus. It's not so much about your level of understanding, but your commitment to Akash Baruch Hu from a sense of complete connection to him, not necessarily coming from intellectual understanding. But, as he points out, that's really what it means. It means that you are intellectually telling him that because you understand rationally, intellectually, that that is the relationship to have with Akash Baruch Hu. So that's what creates your tmimus. Your tmimus is not a simplistic tmimus that comes from a lack of knowledge. Rather, it comes from a recognition that that's the key to life. And that's what ends up being a protection against all kinds of other challenges. And that's what brings the Olam Haba into Olam Hazeh. So that's what this Medrash is saying. That why was he shalem in all of these three ways? The Lama, because he was an Ish Tam Yeshiva Holim, that he was able to bring the Olam Haba to Olam Hazeh through the sense of Tmimus, and that's what created a protection. Okay, it's interesting to look there in this comment on this pasuk, and there's a footnote to tell you where to look in the Sefer and Pirkei Avos, where he gets into this theme. So, Vayiken es Chelkas Asada Asher Noto Shama Halo Miyad Bnei Chamor Avishchem B'mei Kshita. So he purchased this section of land. Chalkas Asada happens to be the title of the Sefer of Shalos and Shuvas of the Eliezer Deutsch, if you want to take a look. Not so relevant to understand the Pasuk, though. Asher Nata Shama Alo, that's where he pitched his tent. So he bought that land from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shem, for 100 pieces of money. So here it's significant, the idea that he bought this land. So the Rishonim say that maybe it's because that's where he knew through HaKodesh that his son Yosef would ultimately be buried there, and there's a whole notion of specifically going out of your way to pay for the Mokum Kvurup. And the Bereishis Rabbah has a comment here, which of course is particularly resonant in the modern era and even in the most recent of times. This is unfortunately such a contentious issue right now, that the Bereishis Rabbah emphasizes that there are at least three places where even almost all of them have to agree that we own because we specifically paid for them. It's the Makom HaMikdash, and the Maras HaMachpelah, and Kever Yosef. So, of course, as we know all too painfully, it's Davka, these areas, which end up being the most controversial, and where perhaps even now especially we're seeing that controversy inflamed the most, and it's certainly a certain irony to it. So the Oznaim Latara, Lutzkarav, has the comment over here that the significance of that historical irony is perhaps HaKadosh Baruch Hu's way of showing that he's with us in Galus, that these places which have particular distinction for them, that Davka there, there's a controversy, so it's Ki'ilu HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying that he's also feeling the pain, he's with us in Galus, and that's somehow connected. Okay, so there is also a very striking discussion about the next pasuk. The next pasuk is very difficult to translate, really difficult to know how to render the next pasuk. It says, Vayatzev Shom Mizbeach. So he erected an altar. That part was the easy part. Vayatzev Shom Mizbeach, Vayikra Lo El Elohei Yisrael. So what does that phrase mean? So it sounds like the Pashtus, that's going to be a significant word, it sounds like it says that he called the Mizbeach Kel Elokei Yisrael, and he named it after Ribbono Shel. However, if you look at Rashi, you see that things are a little more complicated. So Rashi understands it like that. We'll read all the words of the Rashi. It's a long Rashi. And then Rashi says at the end, Rabbi Seinu Darshuhu, and this is a reference to Gemara Maseches Megillah and Daf Yud Ches, that the Gemara there reads this pasuk totally differently. Shekash Baruch Hu Karo Yaakov El. That God called Yaakov El. That's how you read the pasuk. By Yibru Lo El Elohei Yisrael, that Kesh Baruch Hu Kel Yisrael called Yaakov El. And that's the Gemara. So Rashi quotes this Gemara at the end of his comment. The Divrei Sora Kepati Shifotzei Sela. That the Divrei Torah splits up into many different interpretations of the Gemara. Says in Shabbos Mechalta Mechamatayim. But in the Ashi Pshuto Shemikra Basi. But like we just said a minute ago about the Pashas. So Rashi saying, well, that's what the Gemara says, but I just want to tell you the Pashut Pshat, so I'm translating it the other way, at least at first. So it's interesting, you know, very often Rashi usually quotes Chazals and works off of Chazals, and here he's kind of resisting it. He's saying, well, that's what the Gemara says, but I'll tell you the Pashut Pshat is something else. So this has halachic nafkaminis. Rav Soloveitchik in his drushes, as quoted in the Chumash of the Rav, notes that first of all there's a nafkamina lahalacha of this pasuk. So what I said before about it's being tricky how to render this pasuk, because the question is, should it be read as kodesh or chol, which has a nafkamina for how a sofer should write a sefer Torah. A sofer has to write a sefer Torah when he writes Shem Hashem. He has to have kavana for Shem Hashem. So what exactly is the kavana of this word? Is this Aleph Lamed? Is this a reference to Kodesh Baruch Hu, or is this a reference to Yaakov? That's one issue. It's interesting to know.
He has kavana for that isn't Shem Hashem, but he has kavana
So that's the question in Poskim, that there are those who are machmer in that also, which really makes things tricky. Then you have to just ask him what exactly this is. It's a question whether that would cause a problem. Some thought it would. The Bereishis Rabbah, the Medrash, has a comment which is consistent with this Gemara in Megillah, that this was what Yaakov was called, that he was called El. That the Medrash says that Yaakov said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're God above and I'm God below. So what does that mean? So doesn't mean chalula to relegate that only to the shemarim. But the Rav, commenting there also, understood that this was an expression of halachta bedracha, that Yaakov was saying that you're the Ribbono Shel Olam who is perceived purely in the Shemaim, but I will represent you on this earth. I will act in your midos so as to fulfill halachta bedracha. There is a fascinating discussion about this in the Sefer Shvilei Pinchas. Shvilei Pinchas are the sichos of the Pinchas Friedman. If you're familiar with him, has many fascinating things to say. And it's called Shvilei Pinchas, the paths of Pinchas, because he has many different styles in the Sefer. He talks about the Shvil HaPshat, and Shvil HaDrash, and Shvil HaRevez, and Shvil HaYisod. He has all kinds of different styles. So there he talks, there's two essays about this Rashi, and the fact that Rashi seems to resist the interpretation of the Gemara. And he notes, among other things, I won't go into it at length, you can read it there if you want to find it, but he notes that there is a machlokas, and we talk about Yud Gimel Midas HaRachamim. It's a big discussion Elul time as you approach Rosh Hashanah. So the Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah, the Sefer Rosh Hashanah, that Yud Gimel Midas HaRachamim that are at the core of the Slichos experience, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wrapped himself up in a talis, whatever that means, and showed Moshe Rabbeinu what to do. He taught him Yud Gimel Midos and said that when the Jews are in trouble, when they've sinned, Yeresu Lefanai Kiseidur Hazeh, they should do like this. So what does it mean they should do like this? So there is a machlokas. Does that mean that they should recite Yud Gimel Midos? Or does it mean more than that, that they should perform Yud Gimel Midos, that Moshe is being told here that if the Jews want to be recipients of Rachmanis, then they should also act in this way of Rachmanis, they should perform these Midos that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does. What's the translation simply of that phrase? Yeah, Lefanai, they should do this, they should do like I'm doing, say them, or they should do these things. So what seems to be at the center of this machlokas is the first of the Gimel Midos, or beginning of the Gimel Midos, rather, is Kael, right? Kael, Racham, Lachanan. So is Kael something that human beings can aspire to? Is that something that is uniquely a divine term? Or is it something that human beings also theoretically could reach? Seems to convey, so it's understood, seems to convey some Midah of strength and power that's used for positive purposes. So is it possible for a human being to reach that? So some understand, he quotes to the Panim Yafos, who was the Rebbe, the Chassam Sofer, so we have the whole Chassam Sofer lineage here, that seems to be that there's machlokas as to whether or not this Lashon of Kael, is this something that we can say by human beings? So if we can't, so then we can understand why it has to mean that they should recite this formula, not that they should act this way, because the language doesn't apply to human beings. But if we say that Kael is theoretically, we use it to mean God, it's a reference to the strength of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it's a midah that human beings also have some access to, so then maybe it's possible to say that that's what we mean by the Yigimo Midos, that you should do this. So that seems to be what Rashi is kind of resisting in the Gemara, that the Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu called him Kael, and Rashi seems to be working off the premise that no, that that's not the pshat, because the pshat is this is a uniquely divine term, and therefore we have to assume the pasuk means something else. So then he has an essay there about the gvura of Yaakov and what it is that he did in order to earn this, and how he could have such a title. It's an interesting discussion. Okay, we need time to get to Chamishi also, so let's move on to that. So Chamishi, as we mentioned already, Chamishi is the episode of Dina, plus a little bit more at the end. There's a lot to say just about this. Again, we're fortunate that we spent some time talking about this year. Anyone listening to this in future years should just know that we talked about this topic previously, so look elsewhere for some of the details. But Aliyah begins, Vateitze Dina Basleya, Asher Yolda Yaakov Liros Duvnosaretz. So Dina went out, and she wanted to see the daughters of the land. And we know that, this seems very literary here, this reference, she went out at the beginning of the Aliyah. So Chazal consider it significant that this is evocative of Leah's quality of being kind of out there, which is phrased negatively here. And in fact, the invoking of both of her parents, there's a lot of discussion about that, we won't get into all of it, but one of the ideas you find that she's identified by both of her parents, Dina, Bas Leah, Asher Yolda, Liako, is that both of them bear some kind of responsibility for what happens to her. That on the one hand, Leah's outgoingness in a negative sense is transmitted to Dina, and she ends up exposing herself to harm. And also, her harm is a function of the fact somehow that Yaakov is held responsible for having hidden her away. That the irony is, so now she's exposed, and she is exposed to danger. That he concealed her from Esav, and Esav, perhaps there was a Pesach for him to do tshuva, he could have married her, and that would have been better for him, and therefore Yaakov is apparently criticized for holding back that possibility, and that's somehow connected to what happens here. So there's a lot to say about this, lots of it's pasuk in general, but the Balei Musar very often focus on this idea, just for a moment, just to focus on the Yaakov part, that it really seems quite astounding to say that Yaakov should be criticized for that. So it's hard to believe that that was the wrong call. I mean, one would think that you have an obligation to protect your daughter, and to worry about her welfare first, and not to see her as kiruv potential for other people. And it's very hard to imagine that we would advise any sane Jewish father that, oh, if you have a wonderful daughter you want to get a shidduch for, you should try to find the worst possible guy, because that way it'll be a good act of kiruv. And the better she is, the more you should find a bad guy, because there's a greater chance that you'll accomplish something for the sake of kiruv. So presumably we wouldn't advise anyone along those lines, and again, if anyone asks you nowadays, it's probably not the way to go. So why would it be that Yaakov would be criticized for this? So the Balei Musar explained, this is a very, very important idea that we find in other places as well. For example, you find this in Parshas Kisisa, that when in the aftermath of the Egel Hazav, which is also where we find the Gimomidos, a little synergy on that point. So in the aftermath of the Egel Hazav, so Kadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, now Psal Lecha, that you should make the second set of luchos yourself. And the Medrash has a comment that Moshe is told he should make the luchos, as opposed to the first luchos which Kadosh Baruch Hu made. Why? Because you should know how hard it is to make these things. They're very expensive. You just casually throw them off the side of a mountain. They don't grow on trees, so you should know how hard it is to make these. So the suggestion seems to be that Moshe needs to be taught a lesson for having destroyed the first luchos, so he gets to make the second luchos, which is hard to understand, because we normally assume that what Moshe did was right. The Gemara says, "Esaluchos asher shibarta, yashikoch shibarta," he did the right thing. So which is it? Did Moshe do the right thing, or is he being criticized? The Balei Musar explained that really it's the same issue, that Moshe did the right thing, and Yaakov did the right thing. There's no question that at the end of the day, we made the right call. But one should not get the impression, this is a hugely important Musar point, that when you have to choose between two difficult issues, when you choose to take, let's say, a harsh step in order to protect something important, so you have to also be sensitive to what was lost with that harsh decision. That even if that's what you had to do, because the cost in the other direction was too great, still you can't say, well, I did what I had to do, so I don't have to worry about the cost and the impact. So that's, I think, especially Meduyuk in the Moshe Rabbeinu reference. There it really seems like that's what's going on. There isn't really a criticism outside this one point that Moshe is being told that, listen, you just have to be sensitive to what a luchos, what a set of luchos goes for nowadays. You have to make it yourself so that you shouldn't think it was free. So within that verse, it's pretty meduyah that that's the whole point. Not that he made the wrong decision, but it's also important that he should know what the cost of that decision was and be sensitive to it. So Balei Musar explained here the same idea that Yaakov, if you're right, it would be crazy to marry your daughter off to Esav, but that was clearly the right call, bottom line. But he shouldn't just think, okay, so that's what I had to do, so I don't care about what happens to Esau. He should have shed a tear about how Esau perhaps everything could have been different, everything could have turned around, and he missed that opportunity, so he had to miss that opportunity, but he shouldn't feel like that's nothing, and apparently that's what the case. Apparently, again, it's less Meduyak here than it is in the Moshe, but in context where you can find it, or it's one more. But perhaps that's the nature of the criticism. Others say, no, that maybe he could have made a difference, that he could have figured out how to really successfully pull off the shidduch from the character, but that's the nature of the criticism. But this is an idea that you find in the Baal Musar that I think is very crucial, because we face these kind of things all the time, where we have to make a tough decision and we have to let someone else pay a price for what we think is the right call. So fine, we have to do that, and we have priorities, and that's the way we have to go sometimes. But we shouldn't just be blithe and not care about the price that others have to pay. We have to also be sensitive to that. Question about that?
Yeah, so when Chazal say that Yaakov is also criticized for not allowing the piece of, it's not criticism at all. It's really that just Yaakov is sensitive. We should learn to be sensitive about, you know, picking the lesser of two evils is still evil.
So it sounds like, see, that's where it's a little bit less in the words than it is in the other case. It sounds like there is a criticism that somehow we can assume that Yaakov made the right call, but without feeling particular rahmanis for Esau. So that feeling of a lack of rahmanis is where there is what to criticize. Now, the Rishiv of Karambiyad, the Baldach has an essay about this also in this parasha, where he expands a little bit on this theme. He has this idea about Yaakov also, but he expands also on the idea about Leah. So Leah is called somebody who was too outgoing, and it connects to the fact that she arranged for the interaction with Yaakov that led to the birth of Yisachar and Zvulun. And there also, so we have to understand, as the Rashi discusses, that that was also the right thing to do, and we find that also, we find that attitude throughout rabbinic literature, that wives who make sure that their husbands pay attention to them and guarantee the birth of the next generation are considered to be tremendously meritorious for that. We find references to that in the tribe, in other contexts, that that's something which is normally a good thing. So the point is that what we see here is that on the one hand, Leah made the right decision in doing that. That she had to arrange for Yaakov to be with her so that she would have these children. That was the right call ultimately. But to do that, so she had to make use of midos that were a little unseemly. She had to act in a way that was a little bit less modest. And okay, sometimes that's the right call. Sometimes that's the way you have to act. But you also have to be aware that this is not perfect. You have to be aware that this is not the way to be, and to feel bad about that, and to guard against its impact. And that's where Leah, perhaps, he brings rise from Chazal, that she didn't totally maintain that attitude, that she basically took the decision, okay, this is the way I have to be, and without so much sensitivity to the fact that it drew upon a midah that wasn't as praiseworthy. And there he says, here, very much al-fi derech hateva, and this fits well now with this pasuk specifically, that the cost of not doing that, the cost of not being aware of, even when you're making the right decision, of trying to keep the negative midos in check, and to watch for that, is that the next generation gets the wrong message, because that which you pass on to the next generation is not your ultimate goals. You pass on your attitudes and your techniques and your skills and your proclivities. So all the next generation sees is, okay, so she's very out there. She's very outgoing in perhaps a not-so-modest way. And that's what the next generation, that's what Dina sees. Because Leia wasn't as careful as she could be to make sure that even this noble motive was utilizing this unseemly quality in a more guarded fashion, since she wasn't so guarded, so that's all the next generation sees. Again, so that's not the gather onesh as much as it is reflecting an aspect of human nature that the children aren't going to know, okay, you did this for the right reason, you did this because it was a necessary call, they just see that's how you are. And that's what they get, and that's perhaps what Chazal are discovering here. And in that sense, then he goes back and says the same point that we said about Yaakov, that Yaakov had a little insensitivity in the way he dealt with Esav, and that again gets passed down. You know, it's a comment in the Sul Sisharim. The Gemara says in Erevin and Dr. Gimel and Mibes that there's a whole discussion there about whether a man is better off being created or not created. So the Gemara says that Noah Foliodam and Shalom Nivra, according to one opinion, maybe a conclusion, better off that we shouldn't have been created in the first place. It's too tricky to pull off everything we have to do. But achshav shenivra, now that we're here, yifashvesh b'masav. V'yikad amri yamashvesh b'masav. So what does that mean? So yifashvesh b'masav, as the Gemara says elsewhere, it means that you should investigate what you do. You should see, am I doing the right thing, am I doing the wrong thing, and make an audit of your actions. But what's the difference between that and yamashvesh? You should kind of feel around. So this is something that Sil Susharim comments on. He says that both of these meanings have significance. That one means you should consider whether you're doing the right thing or not. And then the second, yamashmesh, is that you should think, even if you're doing the right thing, that is there anything in there, like you're kind of feeling it out, is there anything in there that's not perfect? Is there anything in there that might be negative and it may have a long-lasting negative effect? And maybe I have to try to work on getting rid of that, otherwise who knows where it could crop up. And just for a little synergy for our own Masechta, so he also points out there is a very striking Gemara, really a powerful thought, which also relates both to this week's Parsha later on and to Masechta Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Daf Tzadi Tes in the Beis Sanhedrin tells us about Timna, who is identified later on in the Parsha, that Timna was somebody, says the Gemara, who was from noble stock, from noble stock of the Umas Olam. And she wanted to be a Giora. She realized there was something to admire in the nation of Avraham Avinu. And she was sent away. She was rejected by Avraham and his yeshiva. And because she was rejected, so she felt spurned and she wanted to have some kesher. So she became a Pilegesh to Eliphaz, the son of Esav. And what came out of that? A Malek. Says the Gemara, a Malek who has caused problems for the Jews ever since. So it seems like there is a criticism, like there's a kind of statement that because she was rejected, so it's understandable that a Malek comes out of that. So here also she discusses that it must be, you have to assume Avraham is in the cure of business, right? That's everything he does. So clearly he's looking for proper candidates. So if he rejected Timna, it must be that there was something worthy of rejecting. It must be that there was something that justified her being excluded. And yet, at the same time, there's a way to do it. Apparently, she should have done it with one hand pushing away and one hand bringing closer, trying to see how he could be Makariver. And instead, he pushed her away with two hands, and that created a resentment that has passed itself on in generations and is something that we still pay for on Yom HaZeh. Very powerful idea.
Just comment, someone told me that it's even in the word Timna.
Uh-huh.
Maybe Chazal were picking up also not only on creating this kind of concept, but also looking at the word itself, which kind of means like push away or to hold back.
Yeah, could be. Yeah. Okay, so now the pasuk continues. So again, you see it's kind of the straight line that she went out and she was seen, and that was bad for her. Vayaro saw Shechem ben Hamor ha'chivi nisi ha'aretz, vayikach osah vayushkav osah vayamneha. So he basically raped her. That's what it sounds like from the pasuk. He took her and he defiled her. Vatidbak nafsho bedina bas Yaakov v'yehav es hanara. So he loved her. He felt close to her. Some point out that this reflects the fact, Mefarshim point out that this reflects the fact that he found both physical beauty and spiritual qualities in her. So there's two stages. At first he desired her physically, and then, as we've seen from elsewhere in Tanakh, that after he's indulged that, so then he should hate her. He shouldn't be interested anymore. But the interest afterwards that continues, that's a reflection that he actually also appreciated spiritual qualities in her. And was interested in marrying her. So Vayomer Shechem el Chamor Aviv, Lemor, Kachli es Hayalda Hazos Lisha. So Shechem says to his father Chamor, he says, get me that one, get me her as a wife. Yaakov Shama Kitime is Dina Bito. Bito Vanav Hayu es Mekne Basad Vehacher is Yaakov ad Baom. So Yaakov heard about what happened, and he was quiet. Pasuk emphasizes he was quiet until his sons came later. So here there is a comment, or Schwab has a comment over here about why the Pasuk is telling us that he left this for the sons. So here, it's a little bit similar to what we were just talking about a few Purim ago, about the mixture of attitudes and midos and actions, that there are some mitzvahs, says Rabbi Schwab, there are some mitzvahs you could do shalal l'shma, that you can do with bad midos or other ulterior motives, let's say, mixed in. But to avenge someone's suffering, to avenge someone's indignity, so that has to be completely pure. And Yaakov was concerned that there's too much of his own covet that was mixed in. Because here, Chazal tell us that Yaakov actually had set up a lot of the infrastructure for Shechem, had done a lot to help them. And the fact that they could treat him this way, treat his daughter this way, is really a tremendous slap in the face. It was very embarrassing.
Isn't it also an issue, though, that he was a mature person and that he was also not treated with dignity?
Yes, that's also true, and that's also part of it, which we'll get to a little bit, but together with all of that, so this was not just an attack on her, it was an attack on him. So there was the concern that he wouldn't be able to deal with this without a tarubis, his own covet, being involved. So, okay, he leaves it for his sons. So here, the pasuk continues. So Chamor comes to speak to Yaakov. The fathers get together, talk about the shidduch. Uvnei Yaakov bo minasadik kishakvah minasadik kishamam yisatzvu hanoshim v'yichar lehem ma'od ki nevala asad v'yisrael l'shkav espas Yaakov v'chein lo yaseh. So the sons of Yaakov, they came back and they heard about what happened and they were furious. They were very upset. Some point out the language of Bayisatzvu, Bayichalahem, they were both angry and upset, because they're angry at what was done by others, and they also felt bad that maybe they should have been more protective, that there was something that they did wrong, it was a combination of negative emotions. So how does the rest of the pasuk read? Ki navala asa b'Yisrael, that there was this terrible travesty that took place. L'shkavis bas Yaakov, v'chei lo yeyaseh, and that should not be done. The Beis HaLevi has a very important comment on this, which I've said over many, many times here in Yeshiva and elsewhere, a very, very important word. I used to, just a little background about this word. So I used to, when I was a kid, I had to make plans for the future. So, you know, there's always this scenario that would always happen in comedies, that you have somebody who's very distinguished and prominent, he's like the president of the United States, or he's the mayor, or he's the boss of the company, and he's traveling incognito somewhere. People don't recognize who he is. So somebody doesn't know who he is, treats him very disrespectfully, not knowing who he is, and things get worse and worse in the comedic scenarios, and hilarity ensues. So because as a kid I had to plan for the future to figure out, so what would ever happen if I someday became the president or the king or the boss or older, and it was in such a position where somebody doesn't realize how they are not treating me with proper covet. So once they finally discover, after all the comedy has taken place, and they realize who they've been dealing with, so I have to plan, how should you deal with it? On the one hand, you know, your instinct is you want to be machal, you want to be nice, you want to say, oh, it's okay, don't worry about it, you think that's probably the right path. But on the other hand, it's not so nice to be machal so easily in such a case. Because the message is that you're saying, listen, oh, okay, you treated me horribly because you thought I was not a person. You didn't realize I was your boss or I was the president. So the message is that, oh, it's okay to act like that, just you shouldn't act like that to me. So you don't really want to send that message. So, I had to figure out how to deal with this. And I recall hearing one of these Gedolim stories, which, for the purpose of synergy here, may have actually been about the Beis HaLevi, so let's assume that it was. It'll make the story work better. That the Beis HaLevi was on the train, because that's where all Gedolim stories take place. And somebody didn't realize that he was the Beis HaLevi, and thought he was some poor Jew, and treated him very disrespectfully. And afterwards, somebody pointed out, you know, this guy here you're making fun of, that's not just a normal person, that's a Beis HaLevi. So, it's the great-grandfather of the Rav, and the why you hold the story. You know. So, how could you act like that? So, the person gets embarrassed, and he goes over to the Beis HaLevi and tries to apologize. And the Beis HaLevi responds, I can't be Muslim. I can't forgive you. Why can't I forgive you? Because I'm not the victim. you were mavazing me, you treated me disrespectfully because you thought I was Tom, a poor person. So, okay, so it happened to be you made a mistake, but you're disrespecting poor people, so you have to find a regular poor person to come and bemoal you, because I'm not the one who you actually victimized. You didn't realize who I was, so you were treating normal people in a disrespectful fashion. You have to get mechila from them. So let's assume the story is about the Beis Halevi, because it's l'shit also in this pasuk. Because he asks about this pasuk, very important word. I think Tom has an essay about this in one of his svarim, in the Tara L'Melech, if I remember correctly. The pasuk says, "Ki nevala us of Yisrael, this travesty, the shkavas bas Yaakov, to attack the daughter of Yaakov, v'chein lo ye'aseh," and such is not done. So the Beis Halevi said, it sounds like this kind of a tonal shift here. It sounds like, this is a travesty, this is horrible, this is disgusting. Yeah, it's not the minig. No, it's not done. So which one is it? Is it a travesty or is it not the minig? It's not now what's done. So the Beis Halevi pointed to a Gemara. And the Gemara says, let's say you're going on vacation and you have a bag of gold coins in your house. So you ask your neighbor, you ask the lady who lives next door, that you're going away for a week, you want her to watch this bag of coins. You don't totally trust her either. So you don't want her to know that they're gold coins, that they're as valuable as they are, so you tell her they are a bag of silver coins. So then, says the Gemara, that if the coins get stolen in a way that she's liable for, so she is liable only to the level of silver coins. Because, says the Gemara, she's only liable based on her agreement to watch the coins. So she only agreed to watch silver coins. So that's all she's chayev for. She's not chayev for the difference between the silver coins and the gold coins. But, says the Gemara, what if she herself took the coins, or she herself did something actively to cause this loss? So then she's chayiv for the whole value. She's chayiv for the gold coins. So what do you see from there? That if it's just a matter of accepting responsibility, she didn't really do anything wrong otherwise. So okay, so then you're only chayiv based on what you accepted. But in the second scenario, she committed a crime. She did something wrong. So therefore, it's not an excuse when you commit a crime to say, oh, I didn't realize how bad it is. I thought it was just somewhat bad. I didn't realize how bad it is. Like you have in America, I don't know if it's comparable or not, if you have a concept of felony murder, if somebody's committing a crime that's just trying to rob a bank or something, and he ends up killing someone, accidentally even, so he's still liable for the murder because he shouldn't have been robbing a bank in the first place. And once you're committing your crime, so you kind of lose your ability to have a defense of, oh, I was only trying to commit a lesser level crime, I wasn't trying for it to be such an egregious crime. You lose that ability to make that defense if you're doing something illegitimate in the first place. So essentially the pasuk was saying that this was terrible. It's a terrible travesty. L'shkavas bas Yaakov, right? The emphasis is not just that they raped someone, but specifically that it was the daughter of Yaakov. Yaakov, l'chashav Yaakov, l'yor hakar satofor, as we said a minute ago. That was a terrible thing to do. So it sounds like the focus in that part is specifically because of the stature of the people involved. So to that, they could say, well, we actually didn't know. We didn't realize she was so chashuv. We thought she was just a normal girl. We didn't realize it was Yaakov's daughter, so you can't blame us. So that's what the rest of the pasuk is for. V'chein lo yeyaseh. This is something you can't do to anyone. So since it was an illegitimate action, no matter who you're dealing with, so it's not an excuse to say, I didn't realize how bad it is. So that's a crucial part of the sentence. And a very important principle in Kavod Abrios, that there's different levels of Kavod. It's true that different people are worthy of different levels of respect. So if we're just talking about when the king is in disguise and you treat him with less than his full Kavod, so the question is, what are you doing? Are you just failing to recognize the difference between him and the average person? Are you treating him baseline respectfully, like people should be treated? Okay, so then it's not your fault you didn't know he was the king. But if you're treating him in a way that nobody should be treated, you're violating the basic Kavod Abrios, so then it doesn't matter that you didn't know, you're liable for the whole cost of this crime, and that's essentially what the Beis Halevi reads into this pasuk, a very important point. All right?
If someone does a chet that they think is a certain level chet,
mm-hmm.
I remember reading that
not chayav for the hate they thought they were, that they were committing, but rather what they thought they were committing. Isn't that true? In terms of...
It depends what you mean. You know, it's a little bit more a complex topic, because there are different gemaras that make different points, and one of the chatam we're looking at right now is keeping everybody overtime, so maybe we'll just rush, because it is a little bit of a complex point, so much so that we're also not going to read all the psukim now about the attack of, about the revenge of the brothers, because we only have a few minutes left. But again, we're lucky that we have seen this already and the context, so we'll just quickly add a few points and very quickly go over the major issue. So here, Shimon and Levi wipe out the whole city of Shechem, not just the perpetrator, but everybody else also. And as we've discussed a few times, Machlokis, what if any, was the justification? So we have the Rambam's position in Mishneh Torah, in Hilchos Malachim, Perek Tes, Halacha Yudalid, that this was justified because of the mitzvah of Din, that the city of Shechem was obligated to enforce the Shevet Mitzvos, and they failed to do so, so they're Chayiv Misa for that, the Chayiv Misa for every such thing, Asarasan, Zohi Misasan. And the Ramban disagreed. The Ramban says that a couple of disagreements, that it's only a bit blasé, you shouldn't be Chayiv Misa, and we see that Yaakov is very mad at them, and that Dinah means a civil law system, not necessarily the enforcement, the way the Rambam describes it. The Gor Aryeh has understand we talked about in a different context that this is Bidinei Melchama, that Shechem had not just an individual, but the whole city had a national identity, so it was a wartime issue. Others point out as well that there was a concern that they would really be vanquished by this population if there was actual wartime component to it, but in any event, it kind of transitions then, as we talked about at length in a different context, from an individual identity to a national identity. Also, to maybe connect this to a point mentioned a few minutes ago, so some, the Gor Aryeh also, and the Arachayim, and the Ran, and his commentary to Sanhedrin against some synergy, all ask that even if you want to say, like the Rambam, that they were chayiv for failing to carry out din, but it was a little hard. I mean, Shechem was the king, Shechem was the powerful person, possibly the owner of all their land, so it's not like they really could have done so much against him. It seems like they were anusim. So, Nosson Gishbetner, in his comments on the Sefer Laharos Nosson, he writes here that this excuse of being anusim would work if this was the only thing they ever did wrong. But we see, as the Ramban points out, that they themselves were involved in all kinds of errors and all kinds of failings. So therefore, when they fail here also, it's not something that we can excuse them for based on honors, because we see it's a reflection of their general behavior. Just to go for a minute another direction, I mean, back with Kamenetsky and his Sefer Emes Yaakov has a long comment about this, and he asks a number of questions. He says, first of all, why is it again that the Torah tells us that Yaakov was silent, that Yaakov doesn't answer? And also, when he hears about this whole thing with Gemila, I mean, with the Pesukim inside, but we know that the brothers tell the people in the city to undergo a Bris Mila under the pretense that they would marry them. So clearly Yaakov knew that wasn't happening. Yaakov knew that that wasn't the plan. So he must have realized something was up. So then why does he get so angry later? So there's a few other questions. So to deal with all these questions, so Rebecca Kamenetsky says, and perhaps again echoing themes that we've seen already throughout today, that there's two approaches to life. That first, there is the ideal approach that you'll take. You'll always try to do everything on the up and up and everything. B'yashrus and b'tzminus, that's what he calls machshava rishona. That's your first plan. But sometimes you meet people who, like we've seen, and here I guess there's some synergy again. This is the theme of Chamishi now for the third week in a row, right? Coming from Toldos and Vayetze and Vayishlach, about people who are straight dealing with people who are not so straight. So that's, again, a synergy point. So here Yaakov realizes that as much as he would like to just say, listen, come on, guys, this isn't right, give me back my daughter, this isn't the proper way to behave, that wasn't going to fly with these people. So he realized that there was a need to take a different path. So therefore, he stayed quiet because he realized something else had to happen. But he couldn't deal with it himself because Abiyachal Hashem, he was a Bechabadik person known for being honest, so he had to let his sons deal with it. I think we may have to wait for the question, we're going to run out of time, so just quickly make sure the point. But so he let his sons deal with it. So that was initially the plan, that Shimon Levi would deal with it. So he understood they had to deal with it a little bit in a non-straightforward fashion. So when he heard about the Mila, what he thought was going to happen, right, Rabbi Yaakov, is he thought that this was just a plan to weaken them, right? They would all be recovering from their surgery, and then they could go in and take Dina back. And that's the whole point, just a recovery mission, just a rescue mission, not that they were going to go and slaughter everyone. So when that happened, when he saw that they acted with such violence, so that's what he got upset about, because yes, he knew something was up that wasn't 100% straight, but he didn't think it was that, and that's where he got extremely upset. But, as the pasuk tells us, that they kind of respond to him in this just emotional way, but it seems to have its own power to it. The last pasuk in the parak, not in the Aliyah, says, "Vayomru hachizona yaaseh achuzenu." He said, "What, are we going to let our sister be treated like a zona?" So there, we don't see that Yaakov has a response. So the Yaakov Kamenetsky writes that the response comes later in Parshas Vayechi, where he says to the brothers, expresses the fact that they were very temperamental, and he says, "Achalkein b'Yaakov achitzein b'Yisrael," I will split them up and I will scatter them around. Which sounds like an onish, right? It sounds like he's punishing them, but Rashi over there says that he's actually going to make them the Malamde Tinokos, and those who fix the Sefer Torah, he'll send them around as traveling Rebbeim and Sofrim to the whole land of Israel. So says Rabbi Yaakov that this response was actually a good response to HaChazona, that when they said that how could we let our sister be treated like a Zona, so then Yaakov saw that, you know, they really feel for her, that they really are connected emotionally to her needs, and that they just couldn't abide by her being treated this way, and that the fact that they acted in the way the other brothers didn't act, maybe it's not just that they were so temperamental and that they were so instinctive, but that they also really felt a greater kesher and a greater rachmanis. So that's dangerous, like we saw, but that's also a good quality for a teacher and a good quality for somebody who's going to take care of the spiritual resources of the Jewish people. So that's essentially how he ends up responding in Parshas Vayechi. Just to also mention, first of all, an important point that the Chazon Ish, in the Sefer Emunah Bitachon, so he writes, very important, Mr. Haskell here also, that the Iker complaint that Yaakov has, or one of the Iker, what is that, the Iker problem, that Shimon and Levi did was, even if they were justified in other things, but the fact that it was dishonesty involved, that was a problem. The fact that they were deceptive, that's a big chisar, and the Gemara says clearly that one is not allowed to engage in Gnevus Das, even that of Nakum, and therefore that was inherently wrong, and that's connected to the criticism. There's a lot to explore about that, but again, we don't have enough time, but maybe we'll have an opportunity to come back to that. We should also mention that we find as well that part of this, they also took their property. Right? The pasuk goes on to say that after they killed these people, and they also took their stuff. So why did they take their stuff? So the Arachayim explains that that's knas, that they are supposed to be a penalty if somebody rapes someone. So that was a part of what happened here. They took a knas. Even though you could ask, that don't we normally say kim leib the rabbi mine, right? That if somebody doesn't have the chayiv nisim and the chayiv mamon for, you normally putter for the mamon. This pasuk chav zayin that the bnei Yaakov bo al chalalin vayavozu ha'ir asher timo achosam. So that's how the Archaim understands that it was a knas and there's no patur of kim leib the rabbi mine, because he assumes that doesn't apply to bnei Noah. Happens to be that's actually a machlokas Rashi and Tosfos himself. Erevin and dasam machbeis mid aleph. The Rashi says that there is a Ptur of Kimlei by Bnei Noach, and Tosfos says differently. And the Achronim point out that that seems to be the Machlokas, the Ramban and the Rambam. You have all of Choshen Mishpat applying to Bnei Noach also. That Kimlei the Rabbinei seems to be a detail of the Jewish civil system. So do we assume that that also applies to Bnei Noach? That's perhaps the Machlokas. We have almost out of time, just to quickly skip to the end and mention one or two other points. So after the story ends, this Parak Lamed Hay, which is also a part of this Aliyah, so there's more that happens, and just to mention one or two points, So we see that the Devorah dies, Devorah the Menepis Rivka, and she's a very elderly woman, right? This is Yaakov's mother's nurse, so she's clearly very elderly. So she's buried over there. Tachas the Beisel, Tachas Alon, Vayikra Shmo Alon Bachus. So it's called the Tree of Crying. So this idea that it means specifically after crying, so Rav Moshe Feinstein has a comment in the Darash Moshe that it's a strange name to give it, is trying to show that she was worth crying over because she was clearly a big tzaddikah since she had a tremendous hashpah in the family. And she was somebody who one should cry for, but sometimes al pi derech hateva, when somebody's very elderly like she was, so then people don't naturally cry as much because it seems, again, al pi derech hateva. But it was important to emphasize specifically that from her character and her tzidka, she deserved the tears. So therefore, that's why it was named that, in order to represent that it was a loss nonetheless. And we'll just quickly mention another major topic that's here, that here, the second to last pasuk, it says, "V'yomru lo Elohim, Shimcha Yaakov, lo yikarei Shimcha or Yaakov, ki im Yisrael, yeshmacha, v'yikarei shmo Yisrael." So here, Kadosh Baruch Hu is basically, on some level, endorsing what the Malach with the Saros El Esav did in changing his name, ki sarisa Elohim v'adam v'tuchal, because you have fought with God and with man, and you have made it through. So here, the pasuk tells us that, yeah, your name won't be Yaakov anymore, be Yisrael, but we find that that's not as literal as it is in other places, because the Gemara, at the end of the first parak of Brachos, tells us that if anyone talks about Avram and calls him Avram, his old name, so he's in violation of Naseh. It's a bit of Naseh, because the Torah says you're not called Avram anymore. What that means practically, the whole discussion, but it's not in our parasha, so we won't talk about it. But whatever it is doesn't apply to Yaakov, even though here the pasuk almost sounds the same, right? You shall not be called anymore Yaakov. We should be called Yisrael. So we should say the same thing, that you can't anymore call Yaakov Yaakov. So why is it different? So the Gemara says why it's different, because the Pesukim themselves, elsewhere in Tanakh, go back and continue to refer to Yaakov as Yaakov. So that shows us that it doesn't really mean it the same way as with Avram. It doesn't mean that it's an absolute change. It means that they'll both coexist. So that's what the Gemara says, but it doesn't fully explain what the whole story is. So what exactly is the reason to maintain both names? So the Chizkuni has a comment here that Yaakov had to be maintained as a name, because otherwise the accusation might be that Yaakov is the language of fooling people, like Yaakveni Zad Pamayim, so it was maybe a bad name, and reflected something bad about all of these episodes in these past few parshios. So to show that there's no shame attached to it, so we keep both names. The Chasam Sofer has a comment where he notes that Kisarisa, this idea that you have fought with Malach and with God, with people, so that's a name of Chashivas. It's saying, look at you, look how important you are. But the point of the Malach was to say that, yeah, you know, you're important. Don't worry about little things anymore. And become overconfident and become a Balgaivit. There was a Yetzihara there. So Kadosh Baruch Hu's name is different, saying, yes, you have that chashivas, but you also have to hold on to your name that connects you with Anivas, Ekev, the heel. And that's a mentality you have to hold on to as you continue in life and you continue recognizing your new status. And you all know it's also the Chasam Sofer that we see also from usage in Parshas, Ekev, Ahaya, Ekev, Tishmu, that Ekev refers to things at the end, refers to being goal-oriented, and that perhaps that's also the message that even when you've reached this high status, you should still continue to be goal-oriented, you should still continue to have things you're looking to accomplish with focus, and that's the important message here. There was an essay about this. I had a relative who passed away tragically a few years ago, named Eliezer Geltzeller, recently came out with a biography about him. And they also recently published letters of that he wrote in Sichos, a lot of fascinating Torah. So it's a Sefer called Sichos Eliezer. It's available in Sefer Bereishis, a lot of beautiful letters. So he talks at length about this idea, about the balancing of the Yaakov Midah and the balancing of the Yisrael Midah, and also about the Pachim Ketanim, which is the theme earlier in the Parsha, and that the idea that Yaakov stayed by for the small things, the Pachim Ketanim, So Esav, the sorrowful Esav, the Malach was saying, you know, forget about Pachim Ketan and forget about small things. Now you're a big shot, and that's good, and that's kind of the Yetzer Hara. You're basically trying to seduce him into a certain mindset. And that's what we try to fight. We say, yes, he's Yisrael, but he's Yaakov at the same time. And this in the Sichos Eliezer, he goes on to say that he talks very practically. I think his Sichos is given to yeshiva students. You have to still make sure to say good morning to people. You still have to look out for the little guy. You still have to have all this Pachim Ketanim mentality, even when you are Kisarisa. And that's what is being balanced here, that yes, we accept the name Yisrael, but we also hold on to Yaakov at the same time. And he also notes that the idea, the name is based on Kisarisa V'tuchal, you fought and you survived, so you might think that we should name him V'tuchal. That's the point, that he won, that he's able to prevail. But he says, no, that's not the point, because that's up to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Whether you win or not, that's up to God, that's the Yati Yishmai. But the quality he's praised for is Kisarisa, the fact that he's able to fight, he's able to keep up the struggle, even when it's very difficult. That's the quality that Yisrael is named for. And that's also why Yaakov is associated with Ma'ariv. Ma'ariv is the tefillah that we say at darkness, say when we feel alone, when we feel isolated, to be able to keep pushing still at that moment. That's the tremendous yichus of Yaakov and why he gets named Yisrael. And again, that's a theme that's all too relevant to Eretz Yisrael, Medinas Yisrael, Klal Yisrael right now. When we see tremendous darkness, but we know that we say that Am HaNetzach is not afraid, that the Jews are able to keep up that fight even when it seems very dark, even when it seems very, very difficult, very isolated in the face of the whole world. But that's the special quality that Yaakov has transmitted to his descendants, Kisarisa. You're able to keep up the fight no matter how difficult it is. And as is Hashem, Betuchal will prevail, and that's the midah that is passed along. Okay, so we will stop here. We will see the funeral of Yitzchak. Remember the midah of Yaakov of Yitzchak. We want to stop this.